Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
The people who have the greatest immediate power over policy are those people in the national security state itself.
I was staying in my room when I heard a huge blast.
We hear part two of our extended interview with Gareth Porter, conducted in late October. Then Muhammad Khurshid in Peshawar, talking about the dangers after a blast hits the spy agency ISI. Last time, Gareth Porter talked about U.S. policies toward the Middle East, reminding us about Iran and the Bush administration's provocative strategies of using naval forces in a blockade. In October, neoconservative voices made renewed calls for attacks on Iran, despite ongoing negotiations between Iran, Russia, and other countries, including the U.S., on how nuclear materials could be managed jointly. We talked with Gareth Porter about division between groups advising the White House on Mideast policy, and Reuters is now reporting that there is growing concern that Western intelligence coordination on Iran's nuclear endeavors is ineffective and politicized. Finally, we discussed U.S. and NATO reliance on Afghan warlords for security. This, explained Gareth Porter, has reduced U.S. credibility with Afghan civilians.
From the beginning of the U.S. paying off of the warlords to provide their services on behalf of the CIA and Special Forces counterterrorism activities in Afghanistan, it's always been the case that the U.S. visible support for the warlords, well-known support for the warlords, has been a major factor in the politics of that country and has caused the population of the country to question U.S. motives and to really be much more alienated from the U.S. and foreign military presence in Afghanistan than would otherwise be the case.
America's so-called surge strategy for Afghanistan, then, has amounted to big payoffs to warlords and power brokers who deal with opium traders and the Taliban as easily as they deal with the U.S.-supported Karzai government. And investigative journalist Aram Rostin has added another dimension to this story with his report to The Nation about U.S. payments to the Taliban. He writes that U.S. military officials in Kabul estimate that a minimum of 10% of the Pentagon's logistics contracts, hundreds of millions of dollars, consists of payments to insurgents. Meanwhile, America's top diplomat for Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, has been working to get the Obama administration to press the Karzai government to end corruption. Eikenberry has also indicated that the U.S. should pull back from a military strategy and shore up Afghanistan's civil society with improvements to the country's infrastructure. The stage would appear to be set for a reintroduction of Obama's original policy platforms of negotiated solutions to problems that had festered during the Bush years. But in part two of our interview with Gareth Porter, we hear a warning about America's national security state and how two opposing groups keep pushing the Obama White House for military options versus diplomatic ones for Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. Gareth Porter is an investigative historian and journalist. His most recent book, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam. You can read his articles at Interpress Service News and other locations. We'll link to them at our website, talknationradio.org. We asked Gareth Porter if U.S. policy under Bush-Cheney had involved provocations against Iran, and if that strategy were something that former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Bolton and others who might be still powerful in Washington and the Pentagon might want to continue.
Is it Bolton's agenda to provoke Iran into taking actions which could then be the justification? I think absolutely, yes. I mean, this is part and parcel of the strategy which I think Bolton and Vice President Dick Cheney and his staff also were very much involved in trying to push for in the Bush administration. That was clearly at work in the effort by Dick Cheney and his staff to push the idea that the United States should attack across the border in response to this completely phony charge that Iran was behind attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq and that the United States had every legal right and, in fact, should respond to that by attacking Iranian bases, which they were arguing were somehow linked to this alleged Iranian effort to manipulate and to authorize Shia militia to attack U.S. forces. This is what was going on in early to mid-2007. And again, you know, there was the Pentagon, it was the civilians in the Pentagon and the U.S. military leadership who essentially said no to that. They blocked the effort, they blocked the effort by Cheney and his allies in the administration to try to get the White House to go along with the idea of seizing upon this phony argument that Iran was behind attacks on U.S. military personnel in Iraq to try to start a war with Iran. It didn't work, but definitely that was, the idea of trying to provoke Iran was built into that strategy in 2006, 2007.
And to keep Iran from successfully having negotiations that would change the balance of power and authority in a way that the conservatives, neoconservatives, didn't want?
Yes, certainly the neoconservatives wanted to avoid serious diplomatic engagement with Iran. I mean, that was certainly part of their strategy. Dick Cheney, if you go back to 2005, 2006, 2007, Cheney was more or less openly, at least through his staff talking with some people in the news media, was basically sort of biding their time on the assumption that the U.S. negotiators and the European negotiators had such a short leash, they had no authority to really offer Iran anything of substance in the talks that had been going on 2005. And therefore, the Cheney people believed that those talks would ultimately break down and the Iranians would then, return to enrichment. The Bush administration then could justify going back to the military option. And that's exactly what Cheney tried to do then in 2007.
The U.S. has long argued that the war on terror is about U.S. security, other security of countries in the Middle East, Israel among them. But if we look at some of the analysis over the last decade or so of, security matters, we don't see a decrease as of the Bush administration's tenure in the White House. Certainly, there were a lot of people pointing to an increase in the threat posed by terrorism and in the power of those who would engage in it. So where do you think we're heading right now as the Obama administration starts to try to work its way through the minefield of all of these policy decisions? Are we looking at an increased sort of threat that both the U.S. military and others in the region of the Middle East are facing? Or how have things changed, if at all?
I don't think things have changed fundamentally, and I think we're up against the same problem that we had during the Bush administration, which is that we have a national security state which has a bureaucratic vested interest, political vested interest, in maintaining the status quo in terms of their programs, which are now justified on the basis of counterterrorism. For example, and I would offer as sort of a key example of this, the drone attack program in Pakistan, which was, of course, started under Bush, accelerated under Bush in the final month before, the final year, I should say, of the second Bush administration. And in fact, Bush gave explicit authorization for a complete sort of changing of the rules, which allowed the Central Intelligence Agency to carry out a much larger number of drone attacks in Pakistan based on much less information, much less certainty about who the target was, and thus ensured that there would be a higher level of civilian casualties because there would be more drone attacks on targets that had been poorly identified and which would be simply civilians rather than high-level al-Qaeda at all. And then, of course, you have Obama coming into power in January of 2009 and being sold a bill of goods by the very people who were whose interests lie in continuing this program. That is to say, the covert operations arm of the CIA. These are the people who, it's their program. They're the ones whose money, whose budget, whose manpower, whose prestige within the government depends on continuation of the program. And they were the ones who were talking about how wonderful this program was, how many high-level al-Qaeda people are being eliminated, and of course they don't talk at all about how many civilians are being killed in the process. And of course, the way they sell the program is to suppress any information that could be used not only by the news media or by critics outside the government, but by other officials within the administration as well, who might be skeptical about this program, but who can't do anything about it because they have no information. I'm pointing to a dynamic here whereby the very bureaucrats who have their own personal and institutional interest at stake in continuing the program are able to sell the program to the White House because nobody else is in a position to offer concrete information to oppose it, because the bureaucrats who own the program also control the information. And I think this is a kind of template for understanding the whole so-called global war on terror, or whatever it's now being called, because I don't think they use that terminology anymore. But basically what we're talking about is a group of programs that all of which have civilian or military managers who have a vested interest in continuing the status quo. And that's what this is all about. It's all about these people and these institutions continuing to maintain their own interests at the expense of the security of the American people. There's no relationship between the two. There can't be any relationship between the two. And I would argue in the strongest terms that only when the American people understand this complete disjuncture between the interests of the national security bureaucracy on one hand and the interests of the American people and their security will they be able to do anything about this problem. Until they understand that, they will be the victims of a bureaucracy that is out of control.
Well, is there a comparison to be made here with insurance companies and, you know, their power to pull things their own way in Washington versus the power of the American citizen?
I mean, I may be alone in the anti-war and anti-militarism movement in embracing this position, but I would caution against sort of an easy making of an analogy between the politics of healthcare and other domestic political issues, which do clearly involve an overweening corporate interest and power in controlling the issue, and the issue that we've been discussing of U.S. war in Afghanistan, the drone attacks in Pakistan, and other programs involving covert operations and other military and civilian programs that have to do with the U.S. presence in the Middle East. I think that those programs are overwhelmingly driven not by corporate interests, but by the interests of the national security bureaucracy itself. I think we must understand the autonomy of the national security state as a political actor and as an economic actor. Both the economics and the politics of this are focused on the overweening power of those national security bureaucrats, both military and civilian, but overwhelmingly the military has the upper hand in regard to control over resources. And so I would argue very strongly that we must not sort of avert our eyes from the central reality, which is that the people who have the greatest immediate stake and the people who have the greatest immediate power over policy are those people in the national security state itself. I'm not arguing that there are not corporate interests behind them, particularly certainly on the military budget. Obviously, that's a huge interest. But the distance between, for example, the drone attacks in Pakistan and corporate interests is very considerable. I think there, you have the clearest example of where bureaucracy is really the driving force, not corporate interest. And I think that is the case for U.S. policy toward Iraq in 2009, as well as in Afghanistan in 2009. I think in Pakistan the same thing is true. We have to take on the military, civilian, national security bureaucracy as the first problem, the primary problem, the overweening problem, not corporate interest.
So you're talking about civilians and the military. What about the State Department? Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to Pakistan and said she supported the drone attacks as part of the war on terror, using that language.
Well, I think that's a good question. Hillary Clinton fits into this overall perspective in two ways. One, as a political figure who aspired to be president and obviously ran for that office, she allied herself with the national security state in very important ways. She was very consciously adjusting her positions over the last few years to make herself acceptable to the military leadership and the civilian leadership in the Pentagon and in other national security institutions. This is very clear from her record. I mean, she never said anything that she didn't feel would be acceptable to those bureaucratic interests. At the same time, of course, she was also ensuring that her positions were not only acceptable, but were enthusiastically received by the Israel lobby in Washington. And that is a very important part of her perspective on the Middle East, and I think continues to be a serious influence on her thinking.
Gareth Porter, where can we learn more about this group of people that you're speaking about now? How can we identify who these people are and what might be done to take them on and change things around a little?
You know, this is not a simple question. You know, you've taken on a tough intellectual issue, in a sense, if you really want to do this systematically. But I would say, to simplify it, you begin with the military services and understand that they have their own political, economic, bureaucratic interests, which are to maximize their budgets, their manpower, their military programs, their weapons systems, their roles and missions, and that those are the biggest single items in the economy, the political economy of the national security state. You're talking about hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars at stake there. And that gives them a degree of power that transcends any other institutions in the national security state. And you have other institutions that really almost revolve around them like satellites. And I would include there, for example, the National Security Council staff, the State Department national security elements, those who deal with military affairs, those who deal with international security, all of those officials in the State Department whose interests, whose issues affect the Pentagon are going to be within the orbit of the military leadership and the civilians in the Pentagon, I should have mentioned, as part of that orbit as well. Then you have the covert operations bureaucracy of the Central Intelligence Agency, who are also a very important part. They have their own sort of independent interests apart from the U.S. military, and there can be very important conflicts between the covert operations bureaucracy and the military, but very often they also work hand in hand and even cooperate on many programs. So, I mean, those would be, very briefly, I think, the key elements of this national security bureaucracy, a set of bureaucracies, each of which has its own interests, but which also form an overall set of interests that tend to cohere and that tend to move forward in the same direction.
Gareth Porter, an investigative historian and journalist, author of several books, his most recent, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam, out in paperback in 2006. Gareth Porter, any clues in that book as to the kind of portrait you're drawing here in modern times?
That's right. I mean, this book is really what caused me to, for the first time, to understand that the national security bureaucracy is really the problem in terms of U.S. national security. It is the enemy, in a very meaningful sense, by which I mean it is the source of insecurity for the American people, because the national security bureaucracy must have conflict, and not only must have conflict, but must use force, must deploy force abroad, and must do so in a way that inevitably is going to provoke both state interests and non-state actors to respond in various ways, which then will, of course, be used by the national security bureaucracy as evidence that we must do more. And so it is involved inevitably in a dynamic that drives violent conflict ever higher, particularly in the Middle East, but not only there. And therefore, we have to understand that the national security bureaucracy is what drives the policies of one administration after another towards war and towards the preparation for war. And that was what I discovered was the problem in the case of Vietnam, that under Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, it was the national security bureaucracy, particularly the military, which was proposing that the United States use military force in Vietnam, and that the White House was very reluctant to do that, but succumbed, certainly after Eisenhower left the White House, succumbed to the pressure emanating from the national security bureaucracy to become involved increasingly militarily in Vietnam. And so it is, in a way, the template for what I see happening today in Afghanistan, as well as in Pakistan, and certainly elsewhere in the Middle East and throughout the globe.
Gareth Porter, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dory.
Gareth Porter writes for Interpress Service. He was co-director of the Indochina Resource Center in Washington. You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dory Smith. We turn now to Mohammed Khurshid in Peshawar, Pakistan, where a blast has ripped through the regional headquarters of the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence agency. Mohammed Khurshid is a journalist now working as a peace activist, and we've been reading his Facebook messages as he and his family have struggled to cope. The Daily Star reported 10 people dead at the ISI complex. Another suicide bombing killed 6 people in Peshawar at around the same time, bringing the death toll for the week to 50. The attack at ISI headquarters November 12th was the second on the spy agency this year. In May, a group attacked a police and ISI building in Lahore, Pakistan, with guns, grenades, and explosives, killing 30 people. In late October, a car bomb hit a Peshawar market, killing 112 people. This after militants were able to hit Army headquarters October 10th, very close to the capital of Islamabad. And each of these incidents has left dozens wounded. Mohammed Khurshid, just tell us how close you were to this bombing and what the climate is in Pakistan amid all of this violence.
The place where the attack was carried out, it was just 2 kilometers away from me. I was staying in my room when I heard a huge blast. It was so huge that it was shared by millions of people in Peshawar, the whole Peshawar city. The population of Peshawar will be more than 10 million. So the blast was very, very huge.
These initial reports in the middle of the night here in America, of course, say that it was the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence agency, that was the target.
Actually, the target was ISI. There are reports of great casualties. At the moment, I think all the roads are closed. The army has been called out. So the exact death toll is unknown at the moment. But it is more than 30 or 40, this the last casualty. And the target was the ISI office.
Now, I know you expressed concern about your safety in October after blasts then, and you thought about leaving Pakistan. Can you just speak to the issue of what it's like there right now?
I think at the moment, the lives of millions of people are in danger. Here, the system has been collapsed completely. I have also personally suffered a lot. Because my family is living in Bajol Agency, which is the center of our terrorism at the moment. Here the army has been carrying out a big operation, but still there is an increase in violence, there is an increase in death and destruction, and there is no hope. The people are losing the hope. My family is nowadays has been living under the open sky. They have been dislodged from their house. My wife is in Bajol Agency, my children is in Bajol Agency, which is the center of war and terrorism. And today, I have heard there is a lack of violence in that area. At the moment, we are not in the normal life. We are just running for saving ourselves. Because there is great risk everywhere. The army is also killing the innocent people. Terrorists are also killing the innocent people. And I think the ruler of Pakistan has lost the direction. Now they are directionless. They have no planning. The army operation without any training.
And what do people think about the U.S.? I mean, with America tied so closely to Pakistan's leaders at the moment, do people blame both for this lack of security?
I think now the people have been looking to the United States, because now at the moment the United States can play a role to bring peace and stability to this area. And this is because of the war on terrorism that the system has been collapsed. So now the people have the expectation, and now this will be the duty naturally. If you destroy a system, then you will build that system. So the system has been destroyed. Now the people have been looking to the United States. They have been looking to the U.S. Army even. They should come and eliminate all these criminals, because who are doing this are the criminals. They have nothing else.
But is it political organizations, Mohammed, or criminals taking advantage of, you know, a lack of police or security?
Actually, the Pakistani leadership and United States leadership has been carrying out the army operation. But the army operation is maybe a temporary solution. It's not a permanent solution. The permanent solution is building a system. Actually, our system in Pakistan is very corrupt. So this is the reason that it has been collapsed. There is complete chaos and complete anarchy and panic. The system has been collapsed. So it should be built.
Mohammed Khurshid, I know you've been trying to reach out to the world. You've issued a lot of calls for peace online. And what is your message, really?
I think the American leadership, the American leaders who are coming to Pakistan, and because at the moment the Americans are guiding the leadership in Pakistan, but the main mistake which is being committed by the Obama administration, they are still supporting these corrupt leaders. The Americans can do the best if they start supporting sincere leadership who can deliver, who can know. Actually, at the moment nowadays, we are being ruled by the feudals who are know nothing, who are just, I think, they have no idea, they have no vision. The United States can do best if she starts supporting the sincere leadership instead of these corrupt people.
Just to confirm, Mohammed, you are in Peshawar right now.
At the moment, I am in Peshawar. But my family, my wife and my children is in Bajol Agency. At the moment, I'm in the Peshawar Press Club, just trying to get some attention and do something for the people.
What do you think Pakistanis need the most?
The people just needing honest leadership. And I think they are needing, there are a lot of needs. Because the United States and the United Nations has been giving a lot of money to the ruler of Pakistan, but that money never went to the people. They are just embezzled in the Midwest. So I think the United States should come directly and directly take the control. I think she can play a good role at the moment.
Reports on this bombing in Peshawar are saying that the ISI has been tied to U.S. covert operations against al-Qaeda. They're blaming that.
Actually, the ISI has played a very dirty role in the past. They have created these people. They have brought these people in the tribal area. I think the CIA and the United States are, will be aware of this fact. Are they are ignoring justice state? Are they may be not aware of this fact? But they have played the role in creation of these people. But now, after the pressure, now they are eliminating these people. So, automatically, the militants and who can be called here as Mujahideen, they are against, they went against the ISI. Now, this is a tug of war between the ISI.
So, you're blaming the Mujahideen for this attack?
Yeah.
Well, just talk about the Mujahideen for a second here. I mean, how do you see this group that America did train and fund back in the 80s to fight Russia in Afghanistan?
The moment is very complex. The United States in the past has played a role in the creation of these people because in the Afghan war, they have the need of these people. But after the 9/11, the situation has been changed. So the Pakistan, the ISI, and all these agencies which have the blessings of the CIA, they have created these people, but now they are against these people.
So are you calling on the CIA to do more or not?
Actually, the Pakistani intelligence agencies, the ISI, they are deceiving the CIA. They are just giving wrong information. They are just giving wrong information to the ground reality is totally different. The ground reality is that the people are very, very poor. They are just suppressed. They have been victimized. They have no rights. They have living like slaves. But the information which has been given to the CIA, these people was presented as the people of tribal area. They are presented as militants. They are presented as terrorists. They are the real terrorists are the rulers of Pakistan. This is my point of view. And restoring the order or bringing peace to the area, I think the people will welcome them. This will be a positive role.
Mohammed Khurshid in Peshawar, it's too dangerous now even for his family to be with him. A journalist, he's been devoting his time to trying to find ways to promote peace in Pakistan. Mohammed Khurshid, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, you are welcome.
For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program produced in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.